I was looking for people freed from commercial civilization who might give me direction for doing it myself. Yet after a full year, everyone I'd met fell into one of five categories, none of which was exactly right. First were single men. These guys had achieved self-reliance, but in cutting ties with the economy, they had also severed family bonds, the opposite of what I was on the verge of doing. I wanted blueprints for cohabitation, not hermitry. Next, I met people who, after leading a simple life for some period of time, decided to quit. Cedar's parents, for example. After years of eking out a living, growing food, and selling stained glass at craft fairs, they both got full-time jobs and eventually replaced the barn with a beautiful on-grid home. "We took poverty as far as we could," her dad told me with a laugh. A friend of mine who birthed a baby in a school bus in a snowstorm on a mountain told me that tripping in the snow on the way to the outhouse one night, pregnant, shitting herself, was not what had finally nudged her and her husband to abandon the homestead. It was the prospect of driving the kids 40 minutes to school each day. People who quit the simple life were the rule. I wanted the exceptions. In the third group were people who had launched their vision with considerable wealth or inherited land. I met a family who had deftly flipped a house in the suburbs before the crash, paid cash for acreage, and built an off-grid straw bale house. I envied and admired them, but I couldn't afford to replicate what they'd done. Perhaps the most famous modern homesteader is Ree Drummond, who spun her massively popular Pioneer Woman blog into a series of books and TV shows that extol home cooking and homeschooling. But Drummond acquired her piece of paradise by marrying into a family that ranks among America's largest landowners. There were also those from the tradition of simple living, such as the Amish and the Mennonites. But you had to be born into such a culture. You couldn't just join. And then there were the moonlighters. Western Montana and southern Utah, where I'd lived for two decades, were meccas for back-to-the-landers, as were Vermont and Northern California. But those places were all expensive now, and buying in these days, or even staying afloat, required working an outside job to support a homestead hobby. I admired the commitment of those who'd figured out how to make it work. But for me, a crucial motivation for living simply was to gain more freedom, not to sprint on some treadmill just to pay the bank. "What can I actually do?" asked the British economist E.F. Schumacher in his 1973 book, Small is Beautiful, in the face of intractable tentacles of industry. In the excitement over the unfolding of his scientific and technical powers, he wrote, "Modern man has built a system of production that ravishes nature and a type of society that mutilates man." Meanwhile, the wealthy were stripping the world of its cheap fuels at such a quick rate that poor countries would never get a fair share. Schumacher's solution? "We can, each of us, work to put our own inner house in order." He viewed economics through a Buddhist lens, asserting that the essence of civilization was not in a multiplication of wants, but in the purification of human character. Instead of productivity for its own sake, Schumacher heralded the Buddhist ideal of right livelihood, whose function he defined as threefold: to excel at one's craft, to overcome selfishness by working in common cause with others, and to create useful goods and services. Wendell Berry echoed this. "How can a man hope to promote peace in the world if he has not made it possible in his own life and his own household?"